Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of how the reckless and suicidal brinkmanship in Washington looks to a group of the world's leading economists meeting in the nation's capital. Economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who is currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University, joins us to offer her perspective on government by extortion and the new head of the Fed, Janet Yellen. Then we will speak with another female economist about the new chairwoman of the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, the first woman to hold what is considered the second most powerful position in the world. Pavlina Chernova, a professor of economics at Bard College who served as the Associate Director for Economic Analysis at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability, joins us to discuss the good news at the Fed and the continuing bad news from the Capitol, where the Republicans are offering a truce until November the 22nd before they resume their threat to default. Then finally, we will speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times, Michael Hiltzik, about the letter from the billionaire Koch brothers to U.S. senators where they distance themselves from the current activities of the Tea Party, apparently alarmed at the prospect of the grave damage the actions of the congressional caucus they have supported could do to the economy and to their $70 billion fortune. We'll examine the role of money behind the shutdown and whether money from the business community might now flow to moderate Republicans instead of Tea Party extremists. And joining us now is economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who is currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She's the author of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Griffith-Jones.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Ian.
So, Stephanie, you're in Washington at a conference on the International Macroeconomic Cooperation, where a focus on Europe, et cetera, and the global economy. And surely, and I know you were there with Nobel laureate Joe Stiglitz, who I spoke with yesterday. I imagine a lot of the conversation is about what's happening in Washington, where you are.
It wasn't the aim of our meeting, but obviously we did discuss that. And we are really quite surprised because, you know, the U.S. is always lecturing other countries about having good governance. And now we have a minority group within a minority party in one of the branches of Congress creating problems which are very bad for the U.S. economy and the U.S. people, which also threaten potentially the rest of the world economy. It's quite appalling, really.
And does anybody encouraged in the slightest by the latest offer by the Republican hostage takers that they will not hold the full faith and credit of the United States hostage? They'll delay that for a while, but still they want to shut down the government over Obamacare. So they're offering a few weeks reprieve till almost up till Thanksgiving, and then they'll start all over again. And of course, we don't know whether or not the president will accept this offer. He's indicated that he's interested, but we don't know whether he'll accept it. This is just a pattern of government by extortion, I imagine. Is it? Nobody's thinking that that's a resolution of the situation, are they?
Well, exactly. I mean, it is encouraging that there are negotiations because it's completely unacceptable and dangerous for the U.S. to reach the moment of default. But it doesn't make sense that a law that has been already passed doesn't get funded. So, and also this kind of short leash approach where every couple of months or every month you would have this minority group in the minority party trying to impose different conditions is really very unacceptable. So I think it's a very difficult situation in the sense that these people don't seem to get it, don't seem to understand what the stakes are, and at the same time, the issues are so important.
Well, it's pretty hard to believe that there hasn't been more pressure from Wall Street on the Republican Party. Apparently, it's starting to happen. Most of the Wall Street professionals didn't believe this was possible and that this would happen, but we're certainly not out of the woods. And the economic illiteracy of those people who are holding a gun to the government's head, are a lot of them are saying that the debt ceiling or crashing the economy or failing to pay our debts won't be a big deal as an international
economy. Which is completely absurd. I mean, I think the term used, economic illiterate, is very scary to have people in such important positions like members of Congress who don't understand basic economics. I mean, after all, last time that this kind of antics went on, the U.S. got downgraded by one of the rating agencies. And as regards Wall Street, it has this type of behavior in which it sort of is optimistic, and then suddenly it will change. But the problem is that once it changes, once you get into these kind of negative, vicious circles, it can become very damaging. So it's in a way good that they haven't yet panicked, but they could panic for any reason. And this is precisely what the politicians and the Republicans, particularly the Tea Party, have to understand, that they are bringing upon themselves a very, very large risk. I mean, I've just been to Africa, so many countries have real problems. This is a completely self-inflicted problem, which is, you know, unacceptable. And I think the American people should be all writing to their congressmen and explaining the economics, because I think the average American understands much more economics than many congressmen.
Again, I'm speaking with economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who is currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She's the author of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. And she's in Washington, D.C. at an International Macroeconomic Cooperation Conference, along with Nobel economist Joseph Stiglitz and others, ostensibly there to talk about the global economy and where Europe stands. But this has to be very much dominating the discussion, simply because the U.S. economy, one of the reasons why this is such a suicidal move on the part of this minority of Republicans is that the United States enjoys enormous advantages for being, in effect, the international currency and being the best place on the globe to put your money. I guess it's kind of incomprehensible that people would want to, you know, tarnish that reputation where...
Exactly.
You know, I mean, are you all scratching your heads?
Well, it's very hard because, as you say, it's a major asset in financial markets that you have the most liquid financial market in the world is a market in treasury bills. It's supposed to be the safest asset. And the rest of the world is willing to finance the U.S. deficit and the U.S. fiscal deficit and the U.S. current account deficit. But we've seen that countries like China and Japan are increasingly worried about these antics, and they cannot understand them. Why would you want to undermine faith in your own economy at a time when you actually need the resources? And at a time when the latest projections from the U.S. government show that the problems of debt sustainability in the long term are actually not that serious. I mean, obviously you need a process of medium-term fiscal consolidation, but the situation is for the next 70 years, the latest projections that I saw from the Council of Economic Advisers are actually quite good. So there is no need to create crisis. And what we know from crises in developing countries, that if you have problems, if, for example, the spreads were to go up on U.S. treasuries, you then create a problem, which is much bigger than anyone that you potentially have at the moment, because treasury bills would become more expensive and the U.S. government would have to serve more payments on its debt. And your mortgages would become more expensive and credit for small and medium enterprises would become more expensive. So the U.S. economy would be harmed. And when you should be so happy that you're finally getting, you know, a recovery. It's not big enough, but we look at this with envy because your recovery is much better than the European one. And because you've had a stimulus package, you've had actions from the Fed, and so you should be looking at how to deepen it, how to promote it, how to benefit the majority of Americans. And instead of that, it's just incredible, as you say, this kind of suicidal undermining of your own economy. I mean, most politicians try and benefit their countries and their economies, and this is completely unprecedented.
So, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, my understanding is that already there's a slowdown in buying T-bills and that the interest rates are likely to go up. So even the threat of these actions of defaulting on the debt, even though now the Republicans are offering another stopgap interregnum before they start it all over again, we're already paying a greater price. And again, in terms of economic illiteracy, I don't understand how they can continue to stick to this argument that they're really doing this because they're concerned about the deficits, when last time around, the credit ratings went down, so that means the debt's more expensive. This time, they're messing with the T-bill market, and it's likely to make our cost of borrowing already more expensive, which then adds...
So it's already having effects, as you say, on the cost of government borrowing, the treasury bills, and it will probably, or what has already happened, slow down the economy. And what markets and economists look at is the ratio between debt to GDP. And so if GDP grows a bit less, your ratio of debt to GDP will go up more, and this will make it even more difficult to borrow and could make it even more expensive in the future. So this is, you know, lousy politics, bad arithmetic, and terrible economics. So it's really completely unacceptable.
Well,
but it's good news that there may be at least some breathing space. I mean, it's not enough because you won't have a solution, but it's... But I think we've had some really encouraging news in the last few days in the sense that Janet Yellen has been appointed also to the Fed, has been appointed, and that is fantastic.
Well, let's talk a little about that. Stephanie Griffith-Jones, again, currently the Financial Markets Program Director, Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University, and the author of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. My understanding is that already on the Fed, in terms of the votes, that Janet Yellen has shown that she's actually a little more concerned about Main Street and less concerned about Wall Street, as her predecessors have been, particularly with the quantitative easing, the $85 billion a month of buying bonds that arguably, by trickle-down, it does help Main Street, but it really helps Wall Street more. And my understanding is that she and others in the minority on the Fed are actually interested in more of trying to stimulate Main Street and less subsidizing Wall Street, and particularly interested in more in community banking and how to help people, consumers and average citizens who are underwater with their mortgages. Is that what you hear and that what you understand from her record?
Well, I think there are two things that are very positive about her. One is her deep understanding of monetary policy and credit policy. And as you say, one of the challenges is, I think there are two challenges of monetary policy. One, within the United States, to try and channel, as you say, money to the real economy, to SMEs, for example, through community banking or through small banks or through special programs that can be encouraged by the Fed and by other parts of the government to directly channel money. And secondly is how to manage the tapering, which is very complicated. And I think on that she will also do it in a way that is more careful, both of employment targets, because the Fed has both the, as you know, inflation target and employment target. And also one important thing that one would hope she would look at, which is the impact on emerging economies. Because in the same way that quantitative easing encouraged a flow of money to the emerging markets and appreciated their exchange rates and caused bubbles there, a rapid outflow, if tapering were to be introduced too abruptly, could lead to major reversals and major exchange rate depreciation, major collapses of house prices. So it all has to be done very gradually and with deep understanding of how markets will react. And the fact that she has so much experience at the Fed and the fact that she has taken very moderate policies on monetary issues, I think is very encouraging. And the second issue, I think, where she's very, very good is in her deep understanding on the need to regulate financial markets, because I don't think that Dodd-Frank fully did the job. And above all, it's been so much eroded by the banking lobbies. So it's been so weakened. And it is so important that we do not have another financial crisis, because we know how damaging it is and how expensive it is. And I think she will have, I know some of her professors, including Joe Stiglitz, Jane DeRista, and others, and she has, and from her record, she also has a very deep understanding of financial regulation, which is a very difficult area, but she's somebody who is progressive on this issue, but also has a very in-depth understanding of the needs of regulation. So I think she, both in the macroeconomic policy, I mean the monetary policy in particular, and on the financial regulation, which are really the two main functions of the Fed, I think she can give excellent leadership. And so that, I think, is a good sign. And if there weren't these antics, I think this would have increased probably confidence in the United States and in growth. So that is, but once this problem is solved with the budget and the debt ceiling, I think she will be a fantastic leader.
So Stephanie Griffith-Jones, you're saying that she'll be less concerned about inflation and more concerned about unemployment?
I think she might, on balance, be because. I think that Bernanke has been concerned about unemployment, and this is also one of the strengths of the American system, in the sense that the U.S. Fed has as a target, unlike, say, the European Central Bank, you have as a target lowering unemployment. But then, of course, it's all how much you relatively privilege that objective versus the objective of lowering inflation. And I think that she will be an ardent supporter of also having these real economy targets. And
well,
not for example, increasing interest rates or tapering too soon. But of course, having to take care of the fact that, you know, there is a lot of liquidity at the moment, and there is a potential problem for the future. Not so much of inflation of goods, as is traditionally the case, but of asset price inflation. Bubbles in the stock market, in the housing market, which is the new challenge, which lead then to the problems of financial stability.
Well, just in closing, do you think that there's a possibility of Wall Street and the CEOs? We've already had the Koch brothers who have been fairly vilified, and I'm among those who vilify them, I think, justifiably, for their support of the Tea Party, but they've even backed away from what the Tea Party are up to now. The Chamber of Commerce have made some mutterings. Do you think there's a possibility that there's going to be sufficient pressure? Obviously, the Republicans have contempt for the president, so they're not listening to him. But at the end of the day, do you think they're going to listen to Wall Street and stop this nonsense and this dangerous and reckless insanity?
I think they need to listen to Wall Street. They need to listen to the CEOs of the big companies. They need to listen to the small and medium companies. I mean, after all these people vote for them. They need to listen to the unions. And they are all saying the same thing. Business, whether it's Wall Street or Main Street, whether it's CEOs or workers are all saying a message for you know, please come out with a solution quickly so we are stopping to do this suicidal damage to ourselves. So I think at some point They do need to start listening. I understand that they are in very safe seats and that the people who vote for them seem to not care about any issues. But in the end, democracy surely must work, and they must listen to the forces, the live forces of the economy.
Well, Stephanie Griffin-Jones, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with economist Stephanie Griffin-Jones, who's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She's the author of Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis, and she is in Washington, D.C. at an international macroeconomic cooperation conference with a number of leading world economists. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking further about Janet Yellen, the new head of the Fed. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Pavlina Chernova, who is a professor of economics at Bard College. From 2000 to 2006, she served as the associate director for economic analysis at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability. Since 2007, she has been a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, and she is the co-editor of Full Employment and Price Stability, The Macroeconomic Vision of William S. Vickery. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pavlina Chernova.
Thank you, and good to be with you.
And I just was speaking with your fellow economist, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who's at the meeting with Joe Stiglitz and a group of international economists at the International Macroeconomic Cooperation Conference in Washington. Of course, it's inescapable that the discussions are turning to the extraordinary behavior on Capitol Hill. So we should also comment on that. I'm sure you have something to say.
Well, to use the words of Ben Bernanke, we're in a state of a self-induced paralysis. Ben Bernanke used this phrase to describe Japanese policy during the period of deflation, the lost decade of Japanese economic policy. I'm afraid that the same thing applies to Congress today, and that we are just grinding our economy to a halt due to self-induced obstacles.
And are you in any way encouraged by the offer from John Boehner and the Republicans that they will stop the self-inflicted wound up until about just before Thanksgiving and start all over again?
No, I'm not at all encouraged. I'm afraid that this mode of policymaking is going to become the status quo, that going ahead, we're going to be using either the debt ceiling or the budget to basically prevent the government from functioning on normal basis. And certainly these debates are very counterproductive. The shutdown will have a real impact on the real economy.
And are you surprised by the complacency on Wall Street? I mean, the Koch brothers, who have been widely vilified, and I think justifiably so, did write a letter to the Senate saying we're not to blame, even though they are funding and encouraging these Tea Party groups. And
yeah,
perhaps they feel they've gone too far. But I haven't heard much from the titans of Wall Street except them sort of saying, well, there's zero chance of this happening. And you get the impression that complacency is not entirely called for when you're dealing with extremists.
No, absolutely not. I think there are two things going on. One is the debt ceiling, and I think that Just Wall Street knows that the debt ceiling problem will be resolved very quickly. The second thing is the impact on the real economy. It's not very clear immediately what that impact is going to be, but we are already seeing some signs of problems. Initial claims, unemployment initial claims jumped up. There is some technical problem with the increase, but there is an indication that already private firms that are getting government contracts are not getting them, and they are laying off workers. So I suspect that this will continue. There will be an impact on overall demand and consumer confidence, at which point Wall Street will react. They will price this into their forecast.
So already, though, as Stephanie was pointing out, already the T-bills, which everyone in the world wants to buy, I mean, this is what's so bizarre about this self-inflicted wound, that America is the favorite place for people to park their capital. And U.S. has an enormous advantage for being the reserve currency. And, you know, now there's a bit of a slump in the T-bill market. The cost of interest is going to go up, which means all of this adds to the deficit. So for all these deficit hawks who are holding this gun to the head of their country's economy, I mean, they must be economically illiterate not to understand the hollow nature of their argument that they are concerned about deficits when last time around 2011 we got downgraded, and that means the debt gets more expensive. And this time around, already the T-bill market's drying up. So,
yes, that definitely will have some impact, although interest rates are still, as a proportion of the government budget, are not very large proportion. So you will have, you know, obviously, you know, the cost of borrowing increases and has an impact on government spending. But let's think about the other problem. When you try to cut the deficit, is it actually possible to do so? All of the austerity measures that we have seen in Europe, and we have plenty of examples to look to, have indicated that actually economies are slowing down and pushing government budgets into greater deficits. So they're quite counterproductive. If you're attempting to cut government spending at a time when the economy is not doing well, and you are undermining that meager growth you have, you're actually undermining the entire object of the exercise. I would say that reducing the deficit in and of itself is not a proper object for policy to begin with.
And of course, it's coming down at record speed in any case.
Yes.
So is there any way then for a rational argument like the one that you're presenting here and that previously Stephanie Griffith-Jones presented? Is there any traction for it? Are we living in an alternative universe here between rational thought and irrational action?
What is the way out? Is that the question?
Well, I'm just trying to think, does it count? Do rational arguments count anymore? Because we're having them all the time. We're saying, you know, these are the reasons why this is what's happening. But I feel like we're just talking to ourselves, you know.
Yes, it's certainly what is happening on Capitol Hill does not seem rational at all. I think the general public understands this. And, you know, probably that will be reflected in the polls, except we don't have the luxury of waiting to see the next election, because it is today that we have to take some meaningful action to, deal with the ongoing functions of government, but also to make sure that not only we don't undermine the slow recovery that we have, but that we actually have some, you know, move ahead with growth and employment, very importantly. So, I very much think that this is a bit of an alternative reality, and we are going to either muddle through, which would be the best-case scenario, or we are actually in for some serious headwinds.
Again, I'm speaking with Pavlina Chernova, who is a professor of economics at Bard College. From 2000 to 2006, she served as the associate director for economic analysis at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability. And since 2007, she's been a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, and she's the co-editor of Full Employment and Price Stability, The Macroeconomic Vision of William S. Vickery. Let's turn to Janet Yellen, and obviously, I suppose it's appropriate to have two female economists on today, but there are also indications from her votes on the Fed that she may well be less interested in the QE, $85 billion a month going to Wall Street and perhaps getting some of it to Main Street, getting it to community banks, And I know they voted in the minority on that, but now that she's the chair, perhaps she'll have some more heft. Also, she's indicated that maybe she's more interested in dealing with unemployment than, say, inflation and the other focuses of her predecessors. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, I think it is a very fair summary. It is without a doubt that unemployment and employment issues are going to be front and center of her policy, at least if we are to judge by her past research record and her past testimonies. She has built a career researching the problems of unemployment. She's a serious scholar. She's an excellent forecaster, very qualified, and as she herself says, you know, these are not statistics to me. She takes the dual mandate of the Federal Reserve quite seriously. And I expect to hear a lot of discussion before Congress in her testimony and various public statements that will focus on the issue of unemployment, which will be a big step forward from the current situation.
So is there anything else? I mean, I know that it's sort of trite to say that, you're a woman economist and she's a woman economist and this may be good for it's a good thing. Obviously, it's a good thing that women are promoted and the glass ceiling. Curious enough, in this country, you have this paradox where a little under 50% of households now are headed by women who are the principal breadwinners. But at the top, in the corridors of power, the glass ceiling is still very much intact. So it's not often that women reach high positions in corporate America and certainly heading up the Federal Reserve, which is often referred to as the second most powerful job in the world outside of the U.S. presidency. So,
certainly this is a victory. It's a hard-earned victory, but it's a victory nonetheless, considering that she's the most qualified candidate, and yet she was not the first choice of the president. There aren't too many heads of central banks around the world, but there are some nonetheless. Some developing countries have female heads of their central banks, like Argentina and Russia. So I would say it's about time. We definitely have underrepresentation in our central bank and in presidential or posts or chairs. But I want to go back to the employment issue. It is the power of the bully pulpit of the chairwoman is not to be underestimated. And to the extent that Yellen will focus the discourse on the problems of unemployment, and to the extent that she brings forward these notions of maximum employment or full employment that we used to hold near and dear decades ago, that's a very good thing. It is a separate question whether the Fed itself has the tools to get us to full employment. So, you know, these are two separate issues that we have to distinguish. And my sense is that the Fed can do something, but probably not terribly much, to move directly the unemployment rate down.
And Pavlina Chernova, what about the idea of stimulating community banks, getting money to ordinary citizens and consumers, many of whom are underwater on their mortgages? Is there a possibility that there'd be more of a focus on trickle-down to Main Street as opposed to subsidies for Wall Street?
I think that that will be a positive step ahead. Community banks are vital for our economy, and data even after the crisis indicates that they had picked up lending to small businesses during the crisis when the big financial institutions were drying up funding. So they are really vital, and they need to be supported. The question is how this will be done. What are the tools that the Fed has? Janet Yellen has spoken about the tools that Bernanke has used, and it seems that she will probably continue with QE and with forward guidance, but then potentially opening QE to buying assets from smaller financial institutions, the commercial banks. The question is whether that in and of itself actually makes a difference for banks and their lending abilities. QE1 has stuffed financial institutions with lots and lots of reserves, and that hasn't really translated into a lot of lending. Will the same policy translate into a lot of lending for commercial, for small community and regional banks. I think a much more viable policy might be a policy of some sort of loan guarantees or some sort of implicit or explicit guarantees of refinancing by small banks and providing, you know, loans to households and individuals. So I think it's probably going to come more from the guarantees and the regulatory side rather than from the QE policy itself.
And what about Dodd-Frank, which has been watered down considerably? The banking lobby has been quite zealous in trying to, they've sued it to death and slowed it down, and the Republicans have been trying to thwart the new Consumer Protection Bureau and defund it and stop the head from taking up his position. So it's been going on rather relentlessly. There are indications that Janet Yellen is actually quite sympathetic to more Wall Street reform, more oversight.
Yes, it's not quite clear where she will stand on regulation. We know that during the Clinton era, she did go along with the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, but she has always been an independent voice, and she has spoken against the mega mergers that were taking place in the late 90s. She had warned about the problems with securitization and subprime lending in 2007. So I think that she understands the problems, the regulatory problems that we are facing. I'm hopeful that she will move that needle also in her position.
Well, Pavlina Geneva, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Pavlina Geneva, who is a professor of economics at Bard College. From 2000 to 2006, she served as the Associate Director for Economic Analysis at the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability. And since 2007, she has been a research scholar at the Levy Economics Institute, and she's the co-editor of Full Employment and Price Stability, the Macroeconomic Vision of William S. Vickery. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back talking about how the Koch brothers are distancing themselves from their Tea Party protégés. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzig, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist who has been with the Los Angeles Times for more than 20 years. In that time, he has worked as a financial and political writer and a foreign correspondent serving in Africa and Russia. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and his books include The Plot Against Social Security, Dealers of Lightning, Xerox Park, and The Dawn of the Computer Age, A Death in Kenya, and his most recent work, Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzig.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back with you, Ian.
And in terms of the Koch brothers sending this letter to the United States Senate, to all the senators, basically distancing themselves from the current activities of the Tea Party, I mean, apparently they're alarmed at the prospect of the grave damage that the actions of this congressional caucus that they've supported will do to the economy and to their $70 billion fortune. But what's your take on it? I mean, is this like a sort of having fed a guard dog and it grows up so big that it takes over the house?
Well, I think that's been happening to a lot of the people who've been funding this extreme right wing. Is they've come to the recognition that they've created a monster, the guard dog that you can't control anymore. call it what you will, I think certainly what's happened, the latest opinion polls are very clear. The fact that the Democrats and President Obama have really held firm in a way that nobody anticipated, certainly not the Republicans anticipated they would. This really is beginning to look like a Republican Armageddon, and anybody who was associated with fomenting this shutdown and this threat to the debt limit is going to get splashed with a lot of mud. The Koch brothers, if there's anything they hate, it's attracting a lot of attention, and they're attracting exactly the wrong kind of attention this way. So yeah, they're backing off. They're disavowing this. They're not the only ones. This really has looked like the Republican nightmare, and I think we're going to see a lot of hands being folded over the next 24 or 48 hours.
So it would seem to me, Michael Hilsing, that the deal that's just been offered, where they will suspend going after the they will suspend defaulting on the debt until November the 22nd and negotiate all of the stuff that they want to negotiate in the interregnum. But the long and the short of it is that it's not an end to this situation. So do you think that the Republicans can, in fact, in the terms of the PR war that's going on now, can they win this one while they are being both the arsonists and the fire brigade?
Well, no, I think what the Republicans are looking at is a choice between being blamed for a disaster and being blamed for a catastrophe. I think this offer that they made really, as I wrote today on my blog, really achieves absolutely nothing. And in fact, there were some kickers in there that would have made things worse. I mean, what they were offering was a relief from the debt limit until the Friday before Thanksgiving. And one of their conditions was that they were going to outlaw any of the sort of extraordinary measures that the Treasury has been taking and can take to stave off default for a few days or maybe a week or two or maybe a little bit longer after the debt limit is reached. In other words, they were going to give the country six more weeks of relief, but they were going to make it even harder to deal with their refusal to raise the debt limit. I think this was, as I wrote today, this was clearly a non-starter. And let's not forget that they weren't even offering to resume the government in that time. They were going to now first start negotiating. I think clearly what President Obama said was, that's not the deal. And the Republicans came away. They're meeting tonight all night. I guess the Democrats are meeting tonight all night. Maybe they'll have Democrats and Republicans meeting. But that was an opening salvo that just fell into the ocean pointlessly. So it's a start that the Republicans are coming around and actually starting to say what they want out of this, but they didn't offer anything.
But by being both the arsonists and the fire brigade, they're also basically saying that they're the ones that want to talk and the other side doesn't want to talk. And does this, the fact that they're talking, I suppose, undermines that argument?
Well, I don't really think so, Ian. I think it was so clear, and this offer was so universally ridiculed, that it doesn't look genuine. So, and, you know, with every day that passes, with the shutdown, with every day that passes, more Americans are actually feeling the direct effects. More services that are being cut, more services that people need, and not just poor people or the disadvantaged, but middle-class Americans are discovering that they need the government to do things that they didn't understand were necessary to them, but they're discovering it, and they're discovering they can't access this. It just looks worse and worse. The opinion polls, I can't remember when I've seen such a sharp drop in the standing of either party in a matter of days. As I said, this is Armageddon. There was nothing that happened today that's good for the Republicans, and that includes coming up with this spavined, pointless offer that was rejected. They went off from the White House with their tails between their legs. They know they're going to have to come back, and every time they come back, they're going to basically be capitulating a little bit more. So I really think they do not look good. They did not look good today. This offer does not look good. They thought, over the last few days that if they offered to open pieces of the government bit by bit, that would back the Democrats against the wall. That didn't work. Nobody wants that. Nobody thinks that's a solution. It really looks like the American public is really becoming, is going over on the side of the Democrats. They understand this is a Republican stunt, and it's failing.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Hiltzik, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist who has been with the Los Angeles Times for more than 20 years. In that time, he's worked as a financial and political writer and a foreign correspondent serving in Africa and Russia. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry. His books include The Plot Against Social Security, Dealers of Lightning, Xerox PARC, and The Dawn of the Computer Age, A Death in Kenya, and his most recent work, Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century. So, obviously, all politicians' primary objective is to get reelected. And the extent to which John Boehner appears to be trapped, and many have said that John Boehner wants to keep his job at the expense of hundreds of thousands of Americans losing their job, that he's being sort of bullied by this boisterous and restive caucus of Tea Party extremists, and they've got him over a barrel, and he can't afford to repudiate them because they'll kick him out, and that's why he can't do this so-called clean CR, continuing resolution, and allow the majority to pass it, which would happen with all the Democrats voting with enough Republicans who are upset, and these are the moderate Republicans. So walk us through the political calculus here, Michael Hiltzik. On the one side, we're told that the Tea Party people and their backers are doing these extreme things because they want to stave off an even more right-wing challenger from the further to the right in the Tea Party in primaries. And they also want to make life difficult for the few Democrats in the red states and get them on the record of being in favor of Obamacare and all the terrible things that they believe the government does. And then on the other side, you've got this irony that the PPP polling recently said that they thought that the Dems could pick up the House in 2014 at the expense of the very moderate Republicans who would vote with the Democrats if there were a clean CR vote allowed by John Boehner. Do you see that as an irony?
Well, that would be an irony. But I think if let's look at sort of the larger context here. The fact of the matter is, and we saw this in 2012 in the election, but it's been building for some time, is that the demographics of the American electorate are moving decisively against the Republicans, particularly against the right wing of the Republican Party. In 2012, it really emerged as a regional, marginal party. It happens to have a very strong veto right now in the House of Representatives. It may keep that next year, but in the larger sense, I think governorships are going to move against the Republican Party. It's going to be very hard for them to come up with a candidate who appeals to the emerging demographics of the United States. The United States is becoming much more Hispanic. It's becoming a majority minority. These are not Republican voters. They're certainly not voters for this Republican Party. And as we've seen now over and over again, the Republicans have just been horrible at reaching out to these voters. I think in the next election, or maybe the election after that, you're going to see Texas become no longer a red state, maybe a purple state, maybe even a blue state. So the Republican position, they're going to be defending a smaller redoubt here. You may have, because of gerrymandering and because of the ferocious ideology and the extremism of the the congressional districts that they have, they may be able to hold on to a majority, but they're going to lose a lot of other things, and their position is going to become progressively more tenable. Now, when you talk about whether they could take that, whether they could hold the House, it's hard for the Democrats, but I'm not sure if you really looked at the districts where the Republicans really have no competition, where they're gerrymandered into place, where that's necessarily enough by itself to hold the Republican majority in the House. What the Democrats have always needed is a talking point. Well, now they have one. And I think you are already seeing Democrats running ads against Republicans where there are elections coming up in the next 3 weeks or 4 weeks, hanging this government shutdown around the Republican candidate's neck. That's just a precursor of what you're going to see a year from now when the entire House of Representatives is up for election. And it's the Democrats' task is going to be not to let the voters forget this. This is causing a lot of pain. It is already past the point of no return. It's a disaster economically. We are going to see the effects of this in economic growth figures for the next two quarters at the very least. So it's bad for the Republicans. The Democrats, if they have any intellect at all, are going to figure out how to exploit it. So this is just not good.
So, Michael Hilton, does that mean then that the so-called moderate Democrats, and one of the most outspoken against what his party's doing now is Peter King, and he's very conservative?
Well, he's a Republican.
That's what I'm saying. Let me repeat that. The most moderate Republicans, and prominent among them is Peter King, who is hardly a moderate. I think he's quite conservative, and he would tell you so. He's opposed to it. It's mostly Northeastern and Californian Republicans that the Democrats could get to join them if they got a clean CR to open up the government again. I think that's pretty clear. Now, for their survival, it's probably better that they don't take a vote, wouldn't it be? I mean, aren't these the seats that the Democrats can pick off in 2014? They're not going to pick off the Tea Party seats. That's why these guys do what they do. They're completely immune from...
Well that's true. I think Peter King is not in a strong district. I mean, he represents part of Manhattan in New York City. I don't think it's simply... First of all, there aren't a lot of Northeastern and California Republicans in Congress anymore. That's really one of the ways that the Republicans have become marginalized, is they've lost the Northeast. We know what's happened to them in California. They not only lost, I mean, they lost their veto in the California legislature, which was sort of their last bastion. But I think there are a lot of Republicans, not necessarily moderate Republicans. They can be conservative Republicans, but they can see that this is not good for the Republican brand, and they will vote to restart the government and to raise the debt limit, because they know that the party can't win this. It doesn't mean that they would vote with the Democrats on many other things, but they know that we're really talking about what the number is, 20 or 30, 35 Tea Party, really extremist Tea Party Republicans who are gumming up the works. And, of course, it's Boehner. Every count that I've seen says that if Boehner were to put a clean CR, that is, reopen the government with no conditions and raise the debt limit on the floor, it would win with, it might even win with a majority of Republican votes plus Democratic votes. So I think basically he's trying to preserve something of his coalition by stretching this out to the bitter end. But the government could reopen probably by the end of today if he would do it, and he probably knows it, and he's just going to play it out a little bit longer so that he looks strong. But I don't think you need just Republicans in swing districts in those regions to win. You've got Republicans in the Midwest who think this is insane. You've got Republicans in the Southwest who know they're not doing themselves any favors. So, yeah, and I think, you know, if the Democrats pick up some of these districts like Peter King's district, that would not be bad.
But what are the chances of Boehner allowing a clean CR? That would be the end of him, wouldn't it?
Well, not necessarily. Let's not forget that the entire House votes for Speaker. And I think there's every reason to think that he might not lose his own majority among Republicans to vote him in as Speaker. And even if he did, there would be Democrats who might vote with him. There's always a chance that if Boehner lost the speakership, we'd have a less conservative speaker. You might actually see a speaker from the centrist wing of the Republican Party. So that's why it's so hard for people to really understand what Boehner is up to. He's playing this out as though he can't survive without the Tea Party, but the numbers don't really say that.
Yeah, but isn't the most likely successor Eric Cantor, who is more Tea Party like and hardline than even Boehner is? Boehner seems, he acts like he's a hardliner, but my understanding is that he's not quite that rigid in private as he appears.
Well, I think that would be certainly Cantor is a strong candidate to be Speaker, but if the vote were thrown open and Republican candidates split, then the Democrats might actually have the upper hand and might favor a less extremist, less intransigent Republican. So I'm not so sure that Cantor is as popular among his fellows in the Republican Party as it looks like. We don't really know. That's what makes politics. But I'm not sure it's right to say that Cantor is the inevitable successor, because he might look like an even more extreme Boehner. And there are a lot of Republicans who think that they've been led down to disaster by the intransigence that we have.
Well, ironically, you were just saying a little while back, Michael Hilsing, that the Republicans have finally given the Democrats a narrative for this election next year in 2014. And if that's the logic, then they should be grateful for the Tea Party, and they should want the wrecking crew to be running that place, running the Republican Party into the ground.
Well, I think I think the Democrats have witnessed this Republican crack up with not a little bit of glee, and unfortunately, it's hurt the country. But I think the Republicans in Congress are on a path to self-destruction, and I don't think the Democrats are in a mood to step in and save them from themselves. So, I think the Democrats, are enjoying that. I mean, the stand-up unnerves everybody, including me, and I'm sure you. But I don't think there's any doubt that the American public sees this as a Republican stunt, and they're blaming them for it.
Well, Michael Hilsing, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Hilsing, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist who has been with the Los Angeles Times for more than 20 years. In that time, he has worked as a financial and political writer and a foreign correspondent serving in Africa and Russia. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and his books include The Plot Against Social Security, Dealers of Lightning, Xerox Park, and The Dawn of the Computer Age, A Death in Kenya, and his most recent book is Colossus, Hoover Dam, and the Making of the American Century. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Colin Black. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.